Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.
Hello everyone and welcome back to These Times. I'm Tom McTague.
And I'm Helen Thompson.
Over the past few weeks, one of the most notorious and frankly terrifying organisations that any of us can remember seems suddenly to be back on the offensive despite its apparent defeat 5 years ago. That organisation is ISIS. On top of the attack in Moscow that killed 143 people last month, there have been ISIS attacks on Pakistan, Iran, Syria and Niger, as well as 9 separate ISIS cells that have been broken up by Israeli and Palestinian authorities since October the 7th.
So the question we're going to ask in this week's episode is, from where did ISIS come and why is it still here?
It was just over 90 minutes beyond President Bush's deadline for Saddam Hussein to leave Iraq that U.S. warships and planes launched the opening salvo of Operation Iraqi Freedom.
The hunt for Saddam Hussein is over.
Ladies and gentlemen, we got him.
Tonight, I can report to the American people and to the world that the United States has conducted an operation that killed Osama bin Laden, the leader of Al-Qaeda.
So Islamist militants in Iraq have declared the completion of their Islamic State with a new caliphate under their leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi.
There were multiple terror incidents.
We are continuing to cover the suicide bombing in Manchester.
Police have now confirmed at least 4 attacks in the city of Paris.
Obama, you have started your aerial bombardment in Sham, which keeps on striking our people. So it's only right we continue to strike the necks of your people.
Because the Daesh has lost many commanders and many fighters, he decided, and many command and control is destroyed.
Where the terrorist group ISIS-K has claimed responsibility for an attack that has taken over 130 lives at a popular concert hall near Moscow.
Okay, Helen, this is such an enormous subject to cover with so many different moving parts, but I think it's important to start with just the basics of what ISIS is as an organization. It's a Sunni, very importantly, it's a Sunni jihadist movement whose aim is to establish or re-establish an Islamic caliphate in the, well, across the Muslim world. At first, it's aligned to Al-Qaeda, but it's actually going to become something quite separate. And that's going to be an important part of the story that we'll cover during this podcast. But most importantly, it begins in Iraq, and it begins with this figure of al-Baghdadi that emerges in the anarchy of the post-invasion Iraq. So do you want to take us through the story from the beginning here?
Yeah, what we can see is that in the aftermath of the American-led intervention or the American-led war to overtopple Saddam Hussein in Iraq, that very quickly is what comes to be called the Sunni insurgency against the interim government that effectively the Americans have put in place, and that we see various jihadist groups operating in Iraq at that point, and the most significant of them, as you've said, Tom, is then the one that's founded, or the most significant for the long term anyway, is the one that's founded by al-Baghdadi in 2004. And at that point, I think it's fair to say that al-Baghdadi's ISIS is quite strongly allied with al-Qaeda, that they've both come out of the long-term history of the Muslim Brotherhood, which had been founded back in the 1920s, that we'll come back to in the what we're going to talk about in terms of long-term history in the latter part of the episode. If we then, I think, try to say, well, what was going to be distinctive about ISIS compared to the other groups like al-Qaeda in Iraq at this point, the other Sunni groups, is that al-Baghdadi from the beginning, I think, was not just focused on getting America and the other Western states out, or those who were involved anyway, out of Iraq, but he was also very focused on fighting Shiites in Iraq. So if we want a comparison, I think that al-Qaeda under bin Laden was very driven strategically by an obsession with ridding the Middle East, but particularly Saudi Arabia, from American forces.
Yeah.
Whereas this is got a fundamental intra-Muslim conflict.
It's fundamentally sectarian.
Yeah, bound into it from the start. Now, that doesn't mean that there isn't a complete agenda about pushing the Americans and others, Western states, out of Iraq. But these things coexist. And I think that that is pretty important for what happens much later.
Yeah, absolutely. I was speaking to a colleague of mine, Aris Roussanos, who's an expert on this, over the weekend. And we were discussing the kind of environmental frame for both of these groups, al-Qaeda and ISIS. And in one sense, al-Qaeda is a product of its time and its aspirations. But this is a kind of pre-social media world where they're hiding in caves from these authorities, whether it's the Saudi authorities for bin Laden, or his number two is Egyptian, so he's part of the Muslim Brotherhood, as you say, or from that background. And they're hiding and they're looking for these grand sort of cinematic terrorist attacks that we see in 9/11. Whereas ISIS are born in an anarchic civil war, and their goal is sectarian, and it's about brutal deeds in that moment, in their specific environment. And as we'll go on to discuss, social media then becomes the way that they are able to get their message across into the wider world. It's not cinematic, it's for the mobile phone. Very different, but it's that being in the civil war and being focused on these acts of sort of murderous terrorism towards the Shiite population of Iraq. That's a completely different frame from al-Qaeda. And you'll see the two groups sort of go off in separate tracks over time. But I think that's really understanding it from that perspective is important to understanding ISIS.
In order to see that, we need to say a little bit more about the context of Iraq. And now, obviously, we've talked about the Iraq war, the second Iraq war, I should say, on a number of occasions, because it's so profoundly shaped so much, not only about the internal politics of the Middle East over the last two decades now, but also the politics in a number of Western democracies, not least, obviously, the United States, but not only the
And Europe United more States. Widely as well.
Yeah, and that what we can see is that it's the failure of the American-led intervention after George Bush had famously declared mission accomplished in the beginning of May of 2003 to have any kind of workable plan for how Iraq was then going to be stabilized and how it was going to be governed. Now, there was a clear political consequence to removing not only Saddam Hussein from power, but dismantling the Iraqi army, which was primarily Sunni. And putting in place, or trying to put in place would be a better way to describe this, trying to put in place a democracy, which was going to produce, because the Shiites were a majority, or a majority in Iraq, a non-Sunni dominated government. And in all that, those dynamics put together, I'd say particularly the dissolution of the Iraqi army, was a recruiting drive for organisations like ISIS. And then when essentially disorder, really profound, violent disorder, mm-hmm. prevails in Iraq, which it absolutely does by 2005, then we're in that world where you're just describing, mm-hmm. Tom, in which ISIS can form a rather different kind of, in some sense, a different kind of practical identity, practical political identity, I mean by that, than what Al-Qaeda, the one in which Al-Qaeda has operated.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's even moments where Al-Qaeda seem to be distancing themselves from the kind of brutality.
Particularly, I think that comes later, in when we get on to what happens when ISIS really comes to prominence in 2013, 2014. Maybe we should go there.
Yeah, I mean, so you've got, as you say, like this profound disorder in Iraq, which is the seedbed of ISIS. And then you get the Arab Spring in 2011, which, you know, is obviously across the Arab world, but primarily for the purpose of this story, and I think the most important story of all, is Syria, which collapses into its own disorder. And it's then that you start to get ISIS emerging as a potentially tangible state. Well, al-Baghdadi declares the Islamic State of Iraq and Levant, which is this sort of cross-border state, including parts of Syria and parts of Iraq, in 2013. And so that's 10 years on from when Bush is declaring mission accomplished. I mean, it is extraordinary. And we were talking about this off air, Heather, just before we began the podcast. And I kept questioning you, sort of saying, you said that the end of the Iraq war was in 2003. I thought, that's not right. That's the beginning. And then you reminded me, well, that's when Bush declared victory. Mm. You can't even comprehend that now. And you think back and you think that we're now 20 years on, and it's still chaos in the Middle East. It's sort of more profound, actually. The further we come away from the Iraq war in 2003, the more profound it seems, almost, how profoundly tragic the decision is. So anyway, the Syrian civil war that's happening here then creates the vacuum that then ISIS just sort of spreads like wildfire into it and creates this caliphate that then proposes this problem for Western powers, what on earth to do about it.
Yeah, I think if we think about those at the early 2010s, we can see two trajectories playing out. One, as you said, is directly out of Iraq, because although the Iraqi situation internally stabilizes compared to the depth of the civil war, and the Iraqis form their own government after elections, and indeed that government is able to do certain things that the Americans are keen for them to do, like, you know, inviting Western oil companies mm-hmm. into Iraq, and Obama is able to redeem the promise that he made at the beginning of his presidency, or indeed during the 2008 presidential election campaign, that he's going to have pulled American troops out of Iraq by 2012. It's only a few months after that al-Baghdadi is making ISIS's presence, not only in Syria, but in Iraq, mm-hmm. known. And indeed, when he gets to declaring the actual caliphate, he actually does that in Mosul, in Iraq, rather than in Syria. So one trajectory of this is, you could say, as soon as the Americans have actually withdrawn, mm-hmm. then we see ISIS being pretty significant in terms of what's going on in Iraq. And meanwhile, the uprising in Syria has led to civil war and all the complexities about whether Western states, particularly the United States, is going to intervene in that have come to the fore. But I think it's quite significant that the moment when al-Baghdadi is basically saying, look, now we're operating in Syria, and the group, which was essentially an al-Qaeda affiliated group, has been incorporated into what is now Islamic State of Iraq and Levant, is 6 months before that moment that we've talked about so many times, when Obama is deliberating about whether to go ahead with the attack on Syria after the chemical weapons
mm-hmm.
Moment. So this is a point in which the Western powers, to the extent they ever, or really the United States, ever had any kind of mm-hmm. post-Iraq war influence in the Middle East, have lost control of the situation. And then what's staggering, I think, is that how quickly Islamic State establishes this caliphate. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's territory in northern Iraq and really the whole of eastern Syria that amounts in size terms to pretty much the size of Britain.
And then
there's territory that ISIS is also taking around this time in Libya.
And it's not just desert either. It's like there's a lot of people here in this region. It's perhaps not the size of the UK, but it's a lot of people. This is a significant threat. I think as you were talking there, Helen, it just reminds me that the US had declared mission accomplished, but then to reestablish some kind of order in Iraq had taken the surge that the Americans would then sort of de-surge, if you like, remove, and then you would have a surge in Afghanistan later.
We should just say that the surge in Iraq is 2006. That's, in one sense, you could argue, what creates the apparent conditions that is going to justify American withdrawal.
Yeah. So what's extraordinary about the rise of ISIS here at this time into this chaotic environment is that we are then, the West, are in a position where we, because of the decisions we've taken over the red line, over chemical weapons, Cameron's defeat in the House of Commons, we can't impose order ourselves through some kind of surge, the previous options that we used in Iraq. So we have to impose or try to defeat ISIS in another way. And so we use air power and then local actors on the ground. And in one sense, that the most important one remains the Iraqi army. In Syria, we effectively don't have any allies apart from the Kurds. And the Kurds will become an interesting part of this story as we progress. We're very limited because of this group al-Nusra, which is al-Qaeda affiliated. But in Iraq, the group that we should be able to rely on, the Iraqi government, has effectively collapsed at this point and is left in Baghdad. You remember the scenes where ISIS are approaching Baghdad, and then they're not far away, and Mosul has fallen.
Yeah, Mosul fell in 6 days.
And the Iraqi army kind of just disappears.
There's just huge numbers of desertions.
Which it's a sort of eerie foretelling of the story that we'll see in Afghanistan, actually. And these things that we have created are just shells, or they don't have enough roots into the local soil to survive when they are attacked. And I think so this is like a crucial moment where the West really has to intervene, otherwise Iraq will collapse.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at the situation in the summer of 2014, which is when Obama is making the decisions that essentially the Americans will have to go back into Iraq in one way or another. I mean, it's northern city after northern city in Iraq that are falling to ISIS. You have Jordan and Saudi Arabia moving large numbers of troops to their borders with Iraq because they're so worried about what is happening. And we should just make clear what is happening when ISIS is taking this territory. I mean, large numbers of people are being killed. I mean, whether the minorities are Shiite, whether they're Christians, whether they're Turks, there's genocide against the Yazidis, sexual slavery. I mean, it's quite hard to find words, I think, to describe the awfulness of what happens in the places that ISIS then takes over. And it's incredibly difficult for the Iraqi government to offer any kind of meaningful defense. I mean, I think it's fair to say that by the time, or early 2015 at least, we can say that there isn't such a thing as an Iraqi state any longer. There's the ISIS-controlled territory, there's a de facto Kurdish state in the north of the country, and there's the Shia state in Baghdad and the surrounding areas. And it's really, in some ways, an Iranian sphere of influence. And it's into this that Obama has decided that the Americans have to go back. But as you've sort of suggested, Tom, I mean, this is so little time after he's pulled American troops out of Iraq. And in some ways, that was his flagship foreign policy.
Yeah, absolutely. That was the bad war
commitment. And when he's deciding that American power must be back, he wants the actual commitment of anybody on the ground of American troops to be really primarily, if not entirely, advisory. And everything else has got to be done from the from the air. I think, though, what's striking, though, is in that first period, so after his decision to do that and to organise a global coalition, as he comes to call it, against ISIS and other states are contributing their air power, is how very unsuccessful it is. It does not make a lot of progress very quickly against ISIS.
Yeah, it's. I'm just trying to think back to that moment in time as well, because I think the other element that we need to sort of remember here is how vulnerable Europe felt at this moment. It might be different in the United States because it's so far away, but Europe was a source for a lot of recruitment here. I think there was something like 40,000 Westerners end up joining ISIS. Extraordinary amounts of people. And again, just talking to Aris Roussanos over the weekend, he was saying how this ends up creating a kind of odd feedback loop where you have ISIS being this sort of beacon for the disaffected youth in Europe who then travel to Syria and Iraq into this ungoverned space and take with them the influences from home and the influences that what they're attracted to in ISIS are these gruesome attacks that are filmed and then disseminated on social media. And then the Westerners, Aris pointed out, are often then doing most of these attacks that are then filmed and sent round. So you've got this petrifying scene, effectively, where you've got mass violence, terrorism, beheadings, videos on social media, all of this, Westerners flooding over, an initial failure to defeat ISIS, the vulnerability of much of the Middle East, it seems. We don't know where this thing is going to go. And it's in this moment that outside actors do start getting involved. I mean, principally, we then have to say Russia.
It is. I mean, I think that we could spend a lot of time talking about all the different interventions of regional actors in Syria in particular. But I think the Russian one is crucial. It comes, and we've talked about this before, in September of 2015. And I think the important thing to see is that when Putin makes that move, he very much thinks about it as supporting the Iranian intervention in Iraq and Syria that has already taken place. Because from the Iranians' point of view, is having ISIS attacking Shiites is obviously not something that they're going to that they're going to tolerate. They are the defenders at this point of the Iraqi government. You could say they're more defenders of the Iraqi government at this point than the Obama administration is. And that you see, once the Russians have intervened, is coordination between the Iranian government, the Iraqi government, and the Syrian government. And I think that what's interesting in terms of the effect of this is that it does look like it turns the military conflict against ISIS. And so it's at this point when you start to see a turning of the war to the point where ISIS starts actually to lose territory that it's previously controlled, particularly at this point in Iraq.
So I'm just trying to unpick this a bit, because you've got the Russian intervention mostly in Syria, and it's unbelievably brutal. It's just carpet bombing of cities in a way that Western powers have not been. I mean, obviously Western bombs are just as brutal, but I think the Russians are more aggressive in their assertion of power in Syria. But they're not in Iraq either. That's being left to Iran. But this is happening at the same time that Western governments are still intervening. So there's an element of coordination here between the West and Russia.
Yeah, I think that this is something that we've talked about before, because it's really, in terms of the big geopolitical picture, there's this period between the summer of 2016 and September of 2016, so late September of 2016, where the logic, if you like, of everybody allying against ISIS is very much like coming together, to the point where the Americans and the Russians are planning joint military operations.
And we're allied to Iran at this point as well.
And that is part of the context in which the American election between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump is taking place, and that Hillary Clinton is really positioning herself in a way as a critic of the Obama administration's positioning on this. And Trump is actually aligned with the Obama administration's positioning of let's cooperate with Russia. And then that there's a particular attack, a Russian attack or a Syrian government attack, I can't entirely remember, somewhere that brings that period of cooperation completely to an end. I think that if you look at it from the point of view of the Iranians then in this, their narrative that comes out of the period of 2015-16 and going into 2017 when ISIS territory in Iraq starts to fall and is pretty much gone by the end of the year, is that the Iranian view is that the Iranians have done the hard work, not anybody else. The Iranians backed by the Russians have done the hard work. And that, I think, has consequences for the ways in which ISIS now operates in terms of who ISIS regards
as its
enemy. We'll get to that, obviously, after the break. But I think for now it's important to see the ways in which the logic of ISIS temporarily brings the United States and Russia together, but the complexities on the ground, given you've got all these different powers involved, particularly in Syria, actually make that cooperation impossible in the end.
Yeah, I mean, I must say, I think this is important not just at a high kind of geopolitical level, but at a sort of lower democratic level, in that it becomes more difficult, I think, to see Russia as a kind of pure enemy or the main strategic rival, which was effectively the kind of, we've talked about this, Clinton, the Hillary Clinton position, when you're cooperating them and you obviously have a clear enemy. And it becomes just a much more complex argument to say why we are opposed to Russia in the Middle East, in, say, Syria, because we support secular democratic forces, where the Russians are supporting the Assad regime that we don't support. It becomes much, it's less clear cut. And I think that has an important...
It does. I mean, Kerry himself, John Kerry, American Secretary of State, in that autumn of 2016, I think it's early in the month of September of that year, he says, US and Russia, quote, share the same goals on ISIS.
And then you see it in Europe as well. It's not just in the States, because then you start to see these terrorist attacks in Europe, which then is again this realization of the threat that even allowing ISIS to emerge has created, and even its destruction, it's still there. And you have all of these Westerners that have gone out, and now where are they? And are they coming home? And that is the mindset at the time. And you've got attacks, I mean, mostly on France, I think.
It is. I mean, the first ones, isn't it? The Paris attacks in November of 2015. I think it's true to say that as the military situation in Iraq and Syria, but particularly in Iraq, turns against ISIS, then you start to see that these pretty horrifying attacks on European capital cities, so Paris, Brussels, London, in Manchester in 2017.
I mean, and all this is going on then, Helen, before Donald Trump is elected in 2016, takes over in 2017. And then you have this situation where ISIS is militarily defeated, no longer controls territory in the region, and these proxies that we've been using to defeat them, principally the Kurds for us, become less useful to us. And so at one point Donald Trump says to the Turks, you've got carte blanche, you know, to impose order for yourself in Syria. And this is the moment that leads to something we've mentioned a few times, which is Emmanuel Macron saying that, calling into question NATO itself, you know, that there's been a brain death of NATO. So you can see these ramifications of the chaos playing out long after the actual entity has been defeated, whether it's the terrorist attacks in Europe, you know, the wider security implications, and then the security apparatus that has been in existence since the end of the Second World War.
Yeah, I think that the chronology in 2019 is that ISIS loses the last territory in Syria that it controls in March of that year. And then in October of 2019, then the US kills al-Baghdadi, and that's the point when Trump acts as though the American, to use the language from earlier of George Bush, the American mission, so to speak, in Syria is over. And we should say, and again, we talked about this before, is he'd already actually tried to end the American commitment in Syria back in 2018. And that is what had precipitated various resignations from his cabinet. He'd been restrained. He tries again after the killing of al-Baghdadi. And in doing so, he is effectively, as you said, Tom, allowing the Turkish government to take whatever action it deems from its point of view necessary against the Kurdish groups. And that looks like a tremendous betrayal, because essentially the Kurdish group has been fighting the ground war, protected by American air power. And Trump is, though, stopped from a complete withdrawal from Syria of the kind that he had wanted to pursue. And Macron's case, as you said a number of times, is that Turkey is acting as a rogue NATO member in acting against a Western ally. And from Macron's point of view, the war against ISIS is far from over, because what we haven't been talking about is the fact that during the same period, we'll go back to 2013-14, the French have been fighting ISIS in the Sahel, particularly in Mali. So from Macron's point of view, he wants NATO coherence against ISIS, because he thinks it's still an ongoing, and that's not what he's seeing from Washington. But the logic of it is also that these kind of collision between how do you deal with Turkey, how do you deal with the Kurds, is kind of like baked into a situation where you need the Turkish government to, or the Turkish air bases, in order to deploy this air power. And you're not willing to have American body bags, so you need the Kurds to fight. It's the underlying absence of any coherent American power in relation to the Middle East that underpins the whole dilemma.
And the fact that NATO is not designed as an anti-ISIS organization. It's designed as an anti-Russian organization.
Absolutely. And then you have that sort of 3 months in 2016 where it's US aligned. And Russia aligned.
I mean, we should end it here, the first half, because you can understand Macron's position here. I mean, that France is being attacked by ISIS on its home soil. I mean, those images were I remember it was like France was felt like it was at war, and then it was at war in the Sahel, and yet he's seeing this incoherence and is lashing out against it. But as you say, the incoherence is baked in here. The parts have not yet sort of formed properly.
I don't think they can form properly. I mean, yes. We can come back to this in the
well, let's turn to that, how the parts can't form properly, after the break.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back, everyone. So we left this rather grisly story in 2019 with ISIS, militarily at least, defeated in the Middle East. They no longer control territory. But you already have franchises, if you like, of ISIS in the Sahel and then spreading beyond the Sahel in Africa. And you also have them in Central Asia, with it the center of ISIS-K, as they would become known, and the K stands for Khorasan, which is a sort of old Islamic entity or province in Central Asia, based in Afghanistan. And at the time, ISIS-K is aligned with the Taliban. And of course, at this point, the Taliban are not in government as they are today. They are the insurgent force fighting against the Western-backed government in Kabul in 2019. And this is the story that we need to get into now, because obviously by 2021, with the election of Joe Biden in the November the year before and then coming into power in January, you then have the decision to withdraw from Afghanistan. And then the quick, sudden collapse of the government in Kabul, much like, it has to be said, the scenes that we saw in Iraq that we talked about in the first half of the episode. And then you've got the Taliban in government. But then they quickly become opposed to ISIS-K. And so this is, again, the extraordinarily complicated story here of rivalries within the jihadist movement. But that's the situation that effectively exists to this day.
Yeah, I think that in order to see what's going on here, we need to think through two lenses again, one of which is the way in which these ISIS groups, in this case ISIS franchise, ISIS-K, deals with essentially Western presence in the territories which they want to be part of a caliphate, and the ways in which that they deal with non-Sunni Muslims. So that if you look at the early operations of ISIS-K in Central Asia, is quite a lot of it is directed against Shiite Muslims. And this isn't just in Afghanistan, but in northwest Pakistan, in Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan. And these are places that have been subject to quite significant attacks from ISIS-K. And the project, if you like, is in a territorial sense to reconfigure the region away from the existing territorial boundaries of the existing nation states. The second motivation then is obviously about ridding, in this case, Afghanistan, because it's the place where there are US soldiers and those from other Western countries to pushing them out. And that is where you see the alignment between the Taliban and ISIS-K. But at that moment, when the Taliban win very quickly, as we know, as a consequence of the American withdrawal, the divergence of purposes comes clearly into focus. I think we should say, in that scenes that you were describing, Tom, about when the Americans were leaving Afghanistan, there was the it was probably the first time that ISIS-K really came to Western attention.
Yeah,
because there was the attack, the airport, and that in that attack there were 13 American military personnel killed and around 170 Afghans killed.
Because there'd been a kind of tacit agreement, hadn't there, between the Trump administration previously about withdrawing from Afghanistan, but there wouldn't be Taliban attacks on Western forces while that was happening. But ISIS-K isn't party to this agreement, and they were the ones who attacked the American troops.
Yeah, and I think what's striking once the Taliban are in power in Afghanistan, and that ISIS-K is acting effectively as an insurgency against the new regime in Afghanistan, is that quite a lot of the violence that they deploy is now going against the countries that had been doing the fighting on the Russian and Iranian side in Syria and Iraq. Just to give an example of that, there's a suicide attack on the Russian embassy in Kabul in 2022. So that's a year after the American withdrawal. The same year, you can then see, though, ISIS-K attacks in Uzbekistan and Tajikistan. And so this is an agenda that is now quite removed from its anti-Western focus. In a way, you could say it creates a new logic for cooperation between the Western powers and Russia. But
and Iran.
The geopolitical context is now so radically different than it was when you had that moment of cooperation in the summer of 2016, because we're now into the world of 2022, so the world of the Russian invasion of Ukraine.
Yeah, it's strange. I mean, do you think in a way that the very fact that ISIS, whether it's the franchise ISIS-K or others, are now attacking non-Western governments is an indication of Western withdrawal, of the diminishing Western power? And so the reality is that it was Iran and it was Russia that changed the balance of power in the Middle East. Yes, it was aligned with the Western powers and the air attacks, but a lot of the work was done by those powers who are all defined by being anti-Western. And so it's completely scrambling. And so the ISIS attacking Russia and Iran and Pakistan and these countries seems so confusing to us, but maybe it's an indication of a shifting power in the world.
Also, if you just add in one more thing to that line of thought, Tom, that the group that became quite significant in fighting in the Sahel was the Wagner group, the Russian mercenary group. It was true in Mali. And indeed, when the Mali government basically asked the French to leave, the French soldiers to leave, and that's when the French militarily, for a base, retreated into Niger, which we talked about in the episode we did last year on the coups in Western Africa, the replacement was the Wagner group.
Yeah.
And so that meant that the Russians ended up doing, or who the Russians are in this sense, and the Wagner group is obviously a quite complicated question. But as the French found it ever more difficult to achieve their military objectives in the Sahel, then a Russian-backed group, at least, was the one that ended up providing the support to these West African governments. So if you said, from an ISIS point of view, who are your enemy? Mm. Who's your most consequential enemy? You might come to the conclusion Russia, or at least some version of Russia.
And Iran, because they are the main Shiite power. Yeah. So that would be an obvious attack. But also, thinking back to that episode, Helen, Turkey was a power that was growing throughout North Africa and Africa itself. So Turkey you may see as an obvious enemy or a potential attack target. I'm trying to make sense of this. In a way, what are the lessons to draw? In a sense, ISIS emerges from chaos, from a lack of authority, a lack of order in this part of the world. It grows out of ideas that are rooted in history. You know, the idea of a caliphate is not new. A caliphate has ruled in this part of the world for most of the previous centuries. This is a different century. This is not the norm that we're in today. So it grows out of an idea that is shared by Al-Qaeda, but then it becomes the thing that it is, this violent, millenarian, anarchic organization, because of the unique circumstances that are different from that gave rise to Al-Qaeda. So that's its base. But then it grows and it's allowed to spread in places that don't have a power that is dominant, it seems to me. And that is absolutely the case in the Middle East. There is no caliphate power. There's no Ottoman Empire that controls the area. And the outside powers aren't strong enough to impose their order. America clearly from 2003 on. So it disrupts the order that exists at the time and then isn't powerful enough to impose its order. Russia imposes some kind of order, but isn't strong enough to become a kind of hegemon in the region. China has no interest in being that. And so then what else do we see where ISIS is growing? We see it growing in Central Asia, in Afghanistan and Africa. And I think this is actually quite petrifying in a way. Central Asia is the land that used to be controlled by the Soviet Union. It was the Soviet Union. So the hegemon was Moscow. Afghanistan is this chaotic region that's never really managed to have a hegemonic power rule over it. And so it's constantly changing hands. But Africa is another example of this. And so really, I suppose we shouldn't be surprised that ISIS becomes a growing problem there, not something that that's going to sort of dissipate like it did in the Middle East, territorially at least, or militarily at least. all the conditions are there for it to get a bigger problem over time. And we don't have the ability to impose some sort of hegemonic order there. And it doesn't seem to me that any of the African states, North Africa or West Africa, have that ability either.
I think that trying to think about this question raises some like really hard questions, both about the present world in which we live in its own terms, which I think we can see where the Middle East is concerned, has been shaped now for at least two decades, and I would actually argue for longer than that, by the inability of the United States to structure any kind of order there, despite the fact that for a substantial period of that time, at least, and I would argue actually all the time, that it's had some profound interest in stability in the region bound up with energy.
Mm.
I don't think the Americans have actually escaped their energy interests in the Middle East entirely anyway. And in that sense, it's a story of a part of the world where the dominant power in the world has kept trying to intervene because it does have interest there and has kept failing in terms of the outcomes that its intervention has produced, and that in the wake of the chaos that's come out of that, opportunities for a group like ISIS have kept materializing. And if you broadened the Middle East out to include Afghanistan as part of Central Asia, then that story fits there too. And given that there's an ongoing theme here of not just ISIS but other Islamic groups too, saying Western power, rule by non-Muslims, is not acceptable, that is not an issue that is going away so long as the Western powers keep trying to intervene in the Middle East, and now perhaps not going to do so in Afghanistan. But that's clearly only part of the story, because if that was all that it was about, we wouldn't need to be explaining why it is that Iran and Russia are now targets for ISIS-K too.
Mm.
And we wouldn't need to try to explain why it is that actually some governments in Asia, the Far Asia, I mean by that, struggle with ISIS terrorism as well, because there is also a part of ISIS that exists completely independently, I think, of that, let's call it for the sake of argument, anti-imperial or anti-Western agenda, which is that they want to see Islamic self-rule, that it isn't just about not being ruled by non-Muslims, it's actually having an Islamic state in the sense of having Islamic law, and that being Sunni Islamic law, and seeing people who don't accept that, even if that they're Muslims, as people who they can justify killing.
Yeah, I was speaking to the philosopher John Gray about this, who has, you know, really interesting take on the ideas of modernity and the use of words like medieval that we use to describe groups like ISIS or Al-Qaeda, and just says that it's just the wrong way of thinking about it. They're not, you know, medieval. They might be barbaric, but there's not medieval. They're a product of modernity. They're a product of their circumstances that exist today. And I think that's absolutely right. You know, they're not just a product of the media that exists for them to allow to get their message out, whether that's, you know, TV in the case of Al-Qaeda or social media and the internet in the case of ISIS. They're a product of a failure of modernity in the Middle East, and the failure, the fact that nation states have not worked. They're not producing a high quality of living for many people. They seem to have failed. And so people do yearn for a lost kind of golden age, understandably so. Even if that, you know, lost golden age wasn't as golden as it seems, what is clear for a lot of the Middle East is that the current age is not golden in any sense, unless you're talking about some of the extremely wealthy bits of the Middle East. So I think that's just such an important way of understanding this part of the world, this threat from ISIS as a product of failed modernity. And John has an idea of the future being one of a kind of emerging age of empires again. And I was quite taken by this, because you then think that you have empires that exist already effectively in, say, you know, is China a nation state or is it an imperial state? Russia is effectively trying to recreate a Russian empire. The United States is an empire, obviously. And the EU is a kind of attempted European empire, but without the infrastructure to impose that order. But the Middle East doesn't have one. It doesn't have a power. That's a core way of understanding this.
Yeah, I think if you look at it in terms of like long history, it becomes clear what a really fundamental turning point in world history, the end of the Ottoman Empire was. Because it was prior to al-Baghdadi's declaration of the caliphate in the middle of 2014, the last caliphate was the Ottoman Empire. Mm. And the Ottoman caliphate came after a succession of previous ones. I think there were three previous ones. So the first, obviously from the beginning, emergence of Islam as a religion in the 7th century. The one preceding the Ottomans had begun in the 8th century. It had been first centered on Baghdad and then had moved to Egypt after the Mongol invasion. So that's a continuous history from the 7th century to the 1920s, the early part of the 1920s. And during that period too, you've got, or the long period I mean by that, you've got various other Islamic empires of different kinds and at different point. Think to some of the Persian empires, think of the Mughals. And so that end of the Ottoman caliphate in 1924 is the end of such a long historical era. One, it, in many ways, I think, is quite humiliating for Islam. Yeah. And it's not, I think, at all surprising that this organization, which has some relationship to ISIS in terms of common origins, in terms of at least in a religious sense, the Muslim Brotherhood, begins by the end of the 1920s in Egypt. It's formed in 1928. And it has the ultimate aspiration of creating another caliphate.
Mm.
Now, this is in a world in which the principle of nation states has become absolutely entrenched. I mean, think about the ways in which at Versailles, Woodrow Wilson said the principle of national self-determination had to prevail, albeit in practice that's an extremely complicated thing to do. So Islam is a, right from the end of the caliphate, so to speak, is a challenge to that principle. You see some instances of moves towards there being Islamic states, so Islamic nation states. I mean, there's a breakaway in present-day Xinjiang in China for an Islamic state at the beginning of the early 1930s. You can think about the emergence of Pakistan in the, out of the partition of India in that respect. But the idea that there should be a transnational Islamic community emerges very quickly again after the end of the caliphate. Now, the version that then ISIS represents brings with it all the stuff that you've been describing, Tom. It's kind of a pretty totalitarian version of modernity. But you can, I still think, tell it as part of this story in which there is not an acceptance in the Islamic world, or at least in part of the Islamic world, that nation states should be the organizing territorial principle. The idea of empire in relation to caliphate still go together with each other.
Yeah, and those nations that you mentioned there, like Pakistan, it's an attempt to create a nation out of a religion rather than the other way around. It's not an ancient nation state. It's something new.
I know. And what's really, I think, significant about here is, isn't this not something I'd understood until like very recently, is the ways in which, if you look at what's going on in India in the 1920s, so British-ruled India, as this issue of what happens to the Ottoman Empire, what happens to the caliphate, what kind of state is the independent Turkey going to be? You have Muslim groups in India that are lobbying the British government incredibly hard to say you have to keep the caliphate, that should be British policy. And indeed, Gandhi the Congress movement in India that Gandhi is leading, or effectively leading by this point, is very committed to. You have one of the Muslim leaders in India writing to the Turkish Prime Minister on in November of 1923, any diminution in the prestige of the caliph or the elimination of the caliphate as a religious factor from the Turkish body politic would mean the disintegration of Islam and its practical disappearance as a moral force in the world.
That's amazing. I hadn't realised that. But then I suppose I do often wonder, if you had no interference from outside powers in the Middle East, what would naturally happen? Sort of civil war and then the emergence of a hegemonic power? Is that how kind of power works?
I think here we got to think about how the Ottoman Empire came to an end, because that is clearly a pretty important part of this story, is that it's not just that it disintegrated. It was on the losing side of a war.
Yeah.
And then various parts of its territory, in what we now think of as the Middle East, were taken by the British and the French.
Mm.
And so it was empire replaced by other empires, not over the whole territory that had been Ottoman territory. But the British and the French were trying to be imperial powers in the Middle East in an age in which nationalism had already absolutely taken hold there. Because another way of telling the story of the end of the Ottoman Caliphate is actually the part that Arab nationalism played in that.
Yes, encouraged by the Brits.
Encouraged by the Brits. So, and I think that there's some ways of looking at it in which that looks like a betrayal, in terms of, because it's sort of, if you like, accepting Western frame for thinking about politics, nationalism, rather than accepting the primacy of Islamic unity.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the critique of Woodrow Wilson, imposing a kind of American idea onto a continent in Europe, but also then the Middle East, where it doesn't work in the same way.
But in this sense, it means, I think, that actually that we're just still living through the consequences of the end of the Ottomans, the failure of British, the British and French imperial failure in the Middle East, I think, is largely baked in for the beginning, even though it takes quite a long time to play out. In the big scheme of long historical time, it's not actually that long, like, to play.
Tiny, isn't it? When you've the history that you laid out of controls by various caliphates from the 8th century until the 20th century, and then Britain and France controls bits of the Middle East for, 50 years or something, and then in come the Americans.
The French less time even than that.
Yeah, and we're never, ever going to be able to impose anything like the order that the Ottoman Empire was able to impose. It's just bits of control and then trying to create nation states in this region. The counterfactual history of what happens if the Ottoman Empire didn't fall and the British and the French had decided that it was in our interest that it continued. I wonder, A, is that possible? But B, it would be an incredibly powerful state with all the oil reserves that existed at the time. You know, how would that change the world?
Well, I think the thing you've got to bear in mind, though, Tom, is that the Ottomans were fighting the First World War with the Germans for a reason, from the German point of view, which was that the Kaiser was very keen on Mesopotamia for the same oil reasons that the British and the French were keen on it. And that I don't think that this part of the story can really be written out of it, in the sense of the fact that actually in the development of European empire, or we really should say like West European like empire from the 16th century through the 19th century, then there'd not really been very much attention to the Middle East. We talked about the British taking Egypt, but that's a bit more of an exception. There was the port of Aden, that it's more sphere of influence, and there's a reason for that.
And trying to get somewhere.
Yeah, the thing is because this is doesn't look like it's very propitious from the point of view of European imperial power compared to other parts of the world that were subject to it. The thing that completely changes the whole mindset about it is the discovery of oil, first in Persia in 1908, and then the very strong conviction that there will be oil in Mesopotamia, present-day Iraq, which obviously like turns out to be true. So now the incentive for empire in the 20th century is extraordinarily strong, at the same time in which the conditions for exercising empire because of the rise of nationalism are very weak.
Yeah, God, you think back at that discovery, is it like one of the turning points in sort of world history, I guess. I mean, you won't say it, but you should read Helen's book, Disorder, to get a clear understanding of all of this. I think we've run out of time, Helen, so we should end the episode there. I hope you enjoyed it. We tried not to make it too grisly. It is an extraordinary grisly story, ISIS, but I think it's an incredibly important one. And also revealing of so many of the themes that we've talked about on this podcast over the different episodes. So thanks very much. Please do like and follow and all of that. And see you next time.
And as ever, this podcast was produced by Ewan Daughtry.